Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Room Madness podcast. This is the place for everyone to connect, collaborate, compete, and learn together. My name is David Leverins.
Hi, I'm Guy Katz. I'm a second-year rheumatology fellow at Mass General Hospital.
Hello, I'm Michael, and I'm a third-year medicine resident at UPMC.
And I'm Mike Cunningham, and I'm a first-year fellow here at UNC.
Fantastic. I'm really excited you're all here today. This is the first of our podcasts. We are going to go through the actual teams in the tournament. We're really thrilled right now for several reasons. This year, actually, we're partnering with the editorial staff of The Rheumatologist to distribute the scouting reports that are going out for this year's tournament in the eNewsroom newsletter. So this is the newsletter that's a part of The Rheumatologist organization. And they have graciously agreed to send these out for us, which we're really excited about because it's going to really highlight a lot of the amazing work that the fellows have put into creating these scouting reports. And by the time this podcast is published, you will likely have just received your first installment of the scouting reports for the teams in the cells region. And that is the region we are going to be talking about today. So you all heard this fine crew introduce themselves already. These are some of the authors who created the scouting reports for the cells region, which is really exciting. This has been a dream of our leadership team for a while that we would have fellows on from fellows and other trainees on from the institutions that wrote these scouting reports so that we can talk about what they've learned. Now, before we really get into it, we just want to say the scouting reports are amazing. They're amazing. We have all of them already. They're all done. And they will be slowly distributed week by week by the eNewsroom team. And at last count, we had 70 collaborators from 13 different institutions work together to write these reports. There were 43 fellows, 23 faculty, 3 residents, and 1 medical student who came together to write these reports. So this is learning produced by the learners, and it is amazing. So I just want to just take a moment to thank the trainees from these institutions: Cleveland Clinic, Duke, Georgetown MedStar, Massachusetts General Hospital, Montefiore Pediatrics Rheumatology Fellowship Program, Medical University of South Carolina, Ohio State, South Florida, University of Chicago, UNC, which is the University of North Carolina, UT Southwestern, Virginia Commonwealth University, and Wake Forest. Thank you all to the trainees of those institutions. I think just like last year, the scouting reports are going to be the shining jewel of this tournament. We're all going to learn a lot from them. So thank you all for your contributions. Again, in this podcast, we have representatives of 4 of these institutions to talk about the teams in the tournament. And these are the teams. Remember, the tournament theme is the planet of the rheumatologist. The 16 teams in the tournament are divided into the cells, animal house, machines, and people region. And the cells region is all about getting down to the molecular basis of how rheumatology works on a microscopic scale. So the teams in this region are anti-NET antibodies, cytokine networks, CAR T cells, and PIM kinases. So let's start with CAR T cells. Guy, tell us about this team.
Sure, I would love to. So CAR T cells, soon to be the winner of the cells region, are autologous T cells that are actually manufactured to recognize specific antigens and kill the cells that express them. So they've already been a game changer in the treatment of various hematologic malignancies. And I think we'll find out that they soon will be in rheumatic diseases as well. So CAR T cells have immense potential, and that's for a few specific reasons. One is that since they're a T cell-based treatment, they have the potential for extreme antigen specificity, and they also have the potential for really deep depletion of whatever cells are being targeted. And then another really interesting aspect about how they work is that they have the potential to actually restore tolerance patients who have lost tolerance leading to autoimmune disease. A few ways that they've been considered to potentially have a role in the treatment of autoimmune diseases, and these are all things that have been studied primarily in mouse models with impressive success. The first and most readable one is CD19-directed CAR T-cell therapy. And the way that works, very simply, this is something that we're very familiar with. It's really deep B-cell depletion. So thinking about rituximab on a much higher level. And the reason to think about this is that rituximab itself is really good at depleting peripheral B cells and to an extent tissue B cells, but it doesn't really deplete many of the B cell precursors, and it doesn't get to a lot of the precursors, particularly in the bone marrow. So CD19 targeted CAR T cell therapy has the potential to completely deplete all of those cells. And the reason it's so readily available to be used in autoimmune disease is that these are the cells that are being used in leukemia and lymphoma already. And because we already know what diseases potentially we could use this in. So anything that's really autoantibody driven, like lupus, severe ANCA-associated vasculitis, systemic sclerosis, and rheumatoid arthritis are all diseases that we could very easily see CAR T cells being a game changer in terms of how successful they could be. But there's also other ways that CAR T cells can be used. For example, they can be manufactured to recognize autoantibodies and deplete B cells that are specifically producing pathogenic autoantibodies, as opposed to just depleting all B cells. And there's been suggested the utility of using CAR T reg cells to activate T reg cells to be able to recognize antigens and promote tolerance, leading to a long-term sustained remission or even a cure for autoimmune diseases. And unlike some of the other teams that we're going to hear about soon, the CAR T cells have actually been used. So there was a case report in the New England Journal of Medicine that presented a 20-year-old woman with severe lupus that was refractory to all of the standard treatments, and she got the CD19 targeted CAR T cell therapy and rapidly went into remission. So this is something that I think we have the potential to see in clinical use very soon, and I think has immense potential in terms of how it's going to change our field.
I love it. Thanks, Guy. So Guy has already thrown out some challenges to the other teams that CAR T cells are competing against, and we're gonna kick these around in a little bit, where we're gonna see how they pit up against each other. But we got to learn about the other teams first. So CAR T cells are matched up in the first round against PIM kinases. So Michael M, would you tell us about PIM kinases?
Of course. So PIM kinases are another field, like CAR T cell therapy, where we're at the potential to kind of borrow some learned lessons from our oncology colleagues in order to hopefully better treat our diseases. And in a nutshell, PIM kinases are another kind of kinase involved in cell cycle control. I had a couple of trials out for different various cancers as far as treating those. But there's also some data that PIM kinase is actually involved in rheumatoid arthritis. And the base article for our team went into detail about how PIM is expressed and tried seeing how different inhibitors of PIM kinase worked. And essentially, in summary, the study looked at RA patients versus other rheumatological patients, like such as psoriatic arthritis and lupus, and kind of found that indeed PIM kinase levels were higher in cells, both in the serum and in synovial biopsies, kind of confirming that this was a fairly unique signature in rheumatoid arthritis patients from a like early arthritis cohort. Which is kind of exciting. This study then also did some kind of preclinical work in evaluating using inhibitors of PIM kinase, both specific ones for PIM1 and then with kind of what they termed pan-PIM inhibitors. So also inhibiting PIM2 and PIM3. And in total, there's three different PIM kinases of note. And they kind of also showed that using these inhibitors led to decreased T cell activation, implying that these would be possibly helpful for kind of tampering down the autoinflammation seen in rheumatoid arthritis. And kind of the main other piece of info they tried was also using the PIM kinase inhibitors in mouse model of rheumatoid arthritis and also found similar findings that it seemed to be helpful. And I think this is a really exciting potential target in the pipeline that we have here. To give a little bit more background, PIM seems to be downstream of some of our other drugs we already have out in the market. It's downstream of like the STAT and IL-6 pathway. And, you know, if we could hopefully target something downstream from our more broad targets, that may help us have similar efficacy from our current therapies, but perhaps, you know, less toxicity or perhaps even better benefit as well. Another thing that was analyzed in the study was this new kind of technique called prime flow RNA. They used this to confirm it had good concordance using PCR to evaluate the level of PIM expression in cells. And this also really opens up the possibility of, you know, down the line, us being able to run this kind of testing on different serum samples from patients, trying to see what kind of expression patterns they have, and perhaps having targeted therapy in the future. So I think it's, you know, an overall really, really exciting potential option in the future for patients.
That's fantastic. I like that you all already highlighted the contrast or the similarity of these two teams in that they're borrowing from the oncology field with some really potential early, but potentially phenomenal treatment options in rheumatology. So I'm excited to see what others think later about who's going to win this matchup. I am going to give you a brief rundown of the Cytokine Networks team. And this team, so there's several different inspirations for this team. One is, if you're on Twitter, you know that there's a famous, hilarious ophthalmologist named Dr. Glaucum Flecken, who made a video parodying all of the medical specialties. And when he got to rheumatology, he put us all as this nerdy person who got a new journal and smelled it and said that they were so excited it was new journal day because they had discovered a new cytokine. And that was the caricature of rheumatology. And, you know, it's kind of true. We love our cytokines. But as a relatively new rheumatologist, I think it's pretty fascinating to think about how revolutionary this kind of concept is in the field of rheumatology, to think about our diseases in terms of cytokine networks. And the base article for this team really helps this shine in a novel way. So I was first introduced to the idea of cytokine networks when I was actually a resident. And I was learning about rheumatology, and the late, wonderful program director of Vanderbilt, may he rest in peace, Dr. Howard Fuchs, he was working with me at the VA clinic. I'll always remember, I got done with the clinic and we were talking about different biologics. I was like, what is this biologic and what's this biologic? And you know, he actually pulled up an article for me. It was published in Nature Medicine in 2013 by George Shett. And it showed this kind of tree of different diseases on the tree. And in each of these diseases, which seemed totally different, they were connected by cytokines. And in this article, George Shett and colleagues writes the following. The startling success of targeted cytokine inhibitors indicates that chronic inflammatory diseases depend on fragile communication networks of cytokines, which collapse upon neutralization of functionally vulnerable nodes, such as TNF-alpha inhibitors or TNF-alpha. And, you know, this is 2013, and this was one of these really exciting concepts that we didn't just need broad immunosuppression. We had the possibility of taking out this fragile cytokine network and really impacting rheumatologic disease. Of course, TNF inhibitors had been present for, you know, over a decade, but just this awareness has revolutionized into the way we think about our diseases. And on a daily basis now, we think about diseases in terms of cytokine networks. So just the base article that really highlights this in a new way this year is a study published in the Arthritis of Rheumatology by a group of collaborators from the Precise Systemic Autoimmune Diseases Network, or the Precise AD study. And like cytokines themselves, the methods of this study are incredibly complex. But in general, they applied basically the same highly specialized testing methodologies to analyze cytokine profiles, autoantibodies, and immune cells to understand the inflammatory milieu of four similar but different autoimmune rheumatologic diseases: lupus, systemic sclerosis, Sjogren's syndrome, and rheumatoid arthritis. And basically, they found that these diseases shared a pro-inflammatory cytokine network. It was defined by elevations in a few particular cytokines. In true rheumatologist fashion, I am going to list them right now, and then you will forget them immediately. They are CXCL10, IL-2, IL-6, and TNF. Doesn't really matter for our purpose of this brief introduction what they were. Really, what the main point is that no matter what the underlying diagnosis was, patients with the highest elevations in this particular cytokine profile also had more severe clinical manifestations. So for example, the patients with the highest levels of this profile had kidney involvement in lupus, or extraglandular manifestations of Sjogren's syndrome, or pulmonary, renal, and vascular manifestations in systemic sclerosis. There's lots of other really interesting things they did in this study, and there's lots and lots of takeaways of the study. But really, the big one for me is this: cytokines are extremely confusing, and so are basic science methodologies. However, the overall message of this study is actually one of simplicity, showing how cytokine networks can actually unify diseases by identifying shared pathogenic mechanisms. So I thought this topic was fascinating. I think it's got a great chance, but I'm going to stop there. And it's matched up against another incredible topic, which I'm excited to learn more about from Mike Cunningham. So Mike C., you want to tell us about this one?
Yeah. So perhaps the best equipped to handle puns in this group, I'm going to be talking about neutrophil extracellular traps and really antibodies directed at NETs. So NETs have really exploded a lot in the literature over the past few years, looking kind of been implicated in the pathogenesis for a multitude of disease states: lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, vasculitis. And there's even been evidence for NETs being correlated with thrombosis, for both for antiphospholipid syndrome and other autoimmune conditions, but also with cancer, HIT, COVID-19 infections. NETs seem to really have their hands in a lot of different pots here. And they've previously noted that antibodies against NET have been elevated in antiphospholipid syndrome. So this paper really sought after a new biomarker in order to determine thrombotic risk in patients to really equip us as clinicians in order to risk stratify patients or even potentially who may benefit from anticoagulation ahead of time. And really what they did is they took a population of antiphospholipid patients, lupus patients, unprovoked VTE, healthy controls, and they measured these anti-NET antibodies against kind of thrombotic occurrence, and a few other biomarkers like complement levels and things like that, in order to try to get at not only are they correlated, but is there a potential mechanistic role with these anti-NET antibodies. And what they found was that overall, when looking at it, anti-NET antibodies seem to be correlated with VTE events, particularly the IgG subtype. And kind of when looking mechanistically, they found that in these patients with these antibodies, they found an impaired degradation of NETs. So you had a prolonged exposure to NETs, but also the IgM subtype was inversely associated with complement levels. These are all of them trying to get at how mechanistically they could be pathogenic. But overall, I thought it was a good first step here into trying to kind of better equip us for something we're not great at, which is trying to determine thrombotic risk among rheumatic patients and who really needs anticoagulation. So they did a lot looking at correlation of anti-NET antibodies that I thought was really beneficial. Still have a long ways to go about a causative relationship. But overall, even outside all the NET puns, I think it has a really good role because there's really such a need here. And I think overall, preventative medicine is kind of the gold standard for success in medicine. If we can prevent something from ever happening, I call that the biggest success we can have. So I'm feeling pretty optimistic.
It's great. Thanks for that. That was a great review. And, you know, I also think this is a fascinating topic. You know, I'm sort of already kicking off our next section of kicking around these topics for who we think is going to win. But, you know, I feel like you said I can't remember exactly how you said it, but you're right. For the treatment of antiphospholipid antibody syndrome is incredibly frustrating because we have this one tool, which is anticoagulation, and people still clot through anticoagulation sometimes. And this concept of netosis and even antibodies against netosis now, taking it a step further, helping us understand what's actually going on in this disease is really enticing. And yes, there aren't many patients with antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, especially compared to a bigger disease like rheumatoid arthritis, but these patients are really in need of better understanding of what their disease is and how to treat it. And you are also right. There are some great net puns in this. In the very first iteration of Rheum Madness, before, like several years before we released it into the wild, we did this one called Mechanism Madness just at Duke. And we talked about netosis in gout, and people were able to name their teams. And one of them was nothing but netosis. And, you know, it's just, you know, they went pretty far. So I don't know, Guy, what do you think? Do you think between cytokine networks and anti-net antibodies, who makes it out of the first round? What do you think?
That's tough. I think that they're both such fascinating topics. So, I agree with everything Mike C said about netosis and the impact in antiphospholipid syndrome. And one of the things that I'm most fascinated about it is the association with DVT in people who don't have antiphospholipid syndrome, and the kind of thinking about the spectrum between healthy and autoimmune disease, where it isn't necessarily a switch that flips on or off and is much more of a spectrum as we're learning more and more. You know, going right along that, the association of the anti-net antibodies with COVID. And I think the Blue Ribbon panel is probably going to find that to prevail over cytokine networks, mostly because I think we're used to the cytokine networks more than we are with net. I think it's just more new, and I think that's going to catch people's attention.
That's fantastic. Thanks, Guy. Michael M., I'm curious. So you're a resident. You're about to be a rheumatologist in just a few short months. I'm curious what you think about these topics, you know, cytokine networks, anti-net antibodies, really the whole region. Who do you think is going to come out on top from a resident perspective?
Yeah, so I think as far as the matchup between the cytokine network and the nets, I have to say I'm probably also a little bit biased. APLS is close to my heart. I did some research in med school as well. I have to agree with Guy. I think it's probably going to be the anti-net antibodies. Just to kind of jump off some of the things Guy said, I fully agree. It's just really exciting that we have a new possibility of helping to triage what patients are at highest risk. And I think even as like a whole separate syndrome, maybe this is the answer for some of those patients that I see, unfortunately, not infrequently, that keep clotting for unknown reasons. We run the hypercoagulable workup, it's all negative, and we say to them, we probably have some sort of disorder, we don't know what it is. Maybe it's anti-net antibodies. So I think for those reasons, I can see it really affecting practice possibly in the next couple of years. And at least for me, I think that's why the Blue Ribbon panel may have that one out over the cytokine network. But at the same time, that's also really fascinating as well, and really shows that there likely is more similarity than differences between some of the rheumatological diseases than we think.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I was playing devil's advocate, you know, rooting for anti-net antibodies. I think cytokine networks is still going to go very far, but also I also recognize that I had this very formational experience as a resident learning about cytokine networks. It was like one of the entrants into the beauties of rheumatology for me. So maybe the Blue Ribbon panel will have had similar experiences to me. You never know, but you all make some great arguments. I am also really excited to see who wins the bottom half of this region, the CAR T cells versus PIM kinases, because they're so different. There's an oral therapy that's already in clinical trials and you could say is less complex. It's still early phases. but might have the opportunity to treat a lot of patients. Whereas, you know, I don't know, you know, Guy, you're going to have to convince me a little bit, because CAR T cells, like I may be inducing tolerance. That sounds great. But I mean, I think about cytokine release syndrome and, you know, these things that can happen with CAR T cell therapies. And I don't know. I mean, it sounds like a really complex and expensive treatment. So why, what's the advantage of CAR T over PIM kinases here?
Well, so and I'll preface this with saying that I think that everything that's happening with PIM kinases is very exciting. But I think CAR T cells are exciting on a completely different level. So, you know, PIM kinases are continuing to go after a pathway that we've already been going after, and are likely to be helpful in that pathway, but it's not going to, in all likelihood, it's not going to be anything that's going to completely change the landscape of the treatment of these diseases. Whereas CAR T cell therapy has the potential of taking patients who are on the verge of dying from their diseases, or patients who have gone through every therapeutic avenue that we have and continuing to have severe disease, and it can put them into complete remission in the span of days to weeks.
You're really interesting. Although CAR T cells also sound very similar to daratumumab, which did not go so far in the tournament last year. That's all I'll say. So we'll see. It's interesting. You make a good argument. All right. I'm curious, Michael C. Michael Cunningham, who's going to win? Who's going to win the region? You got to put your money down.
Yeah. If I had to put my money down, I am a big fan of the PIM kinase pathway and the idea of what PIM kinases can be. That being said, I do like the modularity of CAR T cell therapy and the idea that you can go after things we never really were able to target before. That's a very attractive thing to explore more as we run out of options for certain patients. And you kind of weigh that against kind of the issues that JAK inhibitors have had recently, or some of the fears with PIM kinases. I know I'm going back and forth, but I really do like both of these papers a lot.
You can't make the call. We can't force him.
Well, if I'm going to force to make a call, I might have to go with the CAR T cells. I really am curious about kind of the modularity of this and where it can go. It has a lot of potential. A lot of potential.
Okay. Michael M., what do you think? Who's going to win?
Yeah, so I have to give my team some credit here a little bit. I think as the PIM kinases are still, of course, early in the phase, if I'm being honest, like they're early in the pipeline, to say the least. My hope and dream is that perhaps, like, I know, like, everyone's very concerned with like the cardiotoxicity and the increased malignancies out of the oral surveillance trial with JAK inhibitors. Even though this is just the same pathway, maybe it being further down, it's more specific, less side effects. Maybe once upon a time it can replace JAK inhibitors, but honestly, who knows? I think my major concern with the CAR T is just the cost and complexity for patients. Like, it's really a complex thing to do for patients, and some patients may not be able to do that kind of therapy even if it works well. With that said, it's really just such an exciting possibility, and I would give a very slight edge to CAR T just because of that.
Wow, fascinating! All right, Guy, what do you think?
Out of the whole region, I do think CAR T cells is probably going to win, mostly because of how different it is from everything else that we have, and the idea of treating these really severe diseases, and also the idea of inducing tolerance, even though that's much more preclinical right now. But the idea of inducing tolerance and potentially either curing or inducing sustained remission of autoimmune disease, I think is just something that's really exciting.
Interesting. All right. Well, I have to make my little plug for anti-net antibodies. I mean, I love cytokine networks. I really do. And I think it could go really far. Cytokine networks could go really far if the Blue Ribbon panel doesn't just think about the base article for the cytokine networks team, but they think about cytokine networks in general, and they think about what it means for the field of rheumatology as we continue to progress and think about how our diseases are defined by shared cytokine networks. I think that could make the team go really far. But anti-net antibodies, number one, as you pointed out, great puns, which is very important and definitely has weight in this tournament. The number of puns per scouting report, the number of puns per team, the number of puns on Twitter really could propel a team to victory. But also, netosis is in everything. You know, you read the basic pathogenesis of most rheumatologic diseases, and, you know, they're talking about netosis. Netosis is a part of gout, for goodness sakes. And so having the concept of anti-net antibodies, I think, takes an already hot topic that is accelerating knowledge and takes it a step further. So I don't know. We'll see. It's going to be interesting. My call is anti-net antibodies, but thank you all. That was a really fun discussion. And this is the kind of discussion, again, we did this last year. We should remind listeners, we have absolutely no input into what the Blue Ribbon panel decides. They will decide probably without listening to this podcast at all. But this is the kind of conversation that we're hoping that you all get to have on Twitter and in social media and with your colleagues. And as you read through the scouting reports, these are the kind of the ideas we're hoping you'll twist around. And I really enjoyed hearing you all twist these ideas around in your minds. You all did a fantastic job. Just as we round out the podcast tonight, I just want to take a brief moment. And again, last time we talked about how we are trying to incorporate diversity, equity, and inclusion into all of our conversations. And in our last podcast, we talked about Rheumatis is an educational initiative. So we talked about diversity in rheumatology education. We talked about increasing enrollment of rheumatology, of underrepresented in medicine individuals in rheumatology training. So this time we have talked a lot about basic science, but we've also talked about treatments. So as we talked about each of these basic pathophysiologic mechanisms and these early studies of treatments, we've talked about, okay, how could this be used? How could we develop this into a treatment for lots of patients with rheumatologic disease? And so as we think about that, we should think a little bit about the current state of diversity or lack thereof in the development of new treatments in rheumatology, especially as it applies to clinical trial enrollment. So this is a big topic, so we're not going to hit everything here, but just really briefly, you know, we've talked about CAR T cells for a refractory patient for lupus, and we've talked about PIM kinases as a potential treatment for rheumatoid arthritis. So what about diversity in randomized clinical trials for lupus? So in 2018, there was a review published in Current Rheumatology Reports by Felicinu et al. Of race and ethnic groups in clinical trials of individuals with lupus. They looked primarily at ones with a US-based site. And in the United States, individuals identifying as Black encompass 43% of prevalent lupus cases. However, only 14% of randomized controlled trials with a US site actually identified as Black. Representation of Black individuals in clinical trials has actually been declining over time, falling from 20% in the 90s and early 2000s to 10% in 2012 to 2017. The reasons for that are not entirely clear, but it's a big deal. And looking at that and thinking about that is important. Likewise, in rheumatoid arthritis randomized controlled trials, there's a review by Strait et al. In JAMA Open, which showed that in randomized controlled trials of individuals with RA with at least one US-based site, the enrollment of minority racial and ethnic groups is only 16%, despite these populations comprising 40% of the US population. So we have some work to do. And just really briefly to think a little bit about some of the reasons why this can be happening, I just want to put a plug in for an amazing paper that was published in Arthritis Care and Research by Sneed et al. In October of 2021. This is not an all-compassing look of why how to address this issue, but it took one angle of it. These authors applied critical race theory to explore the influence of racism on underrepresentation of Black patients in lupus clinical trials. To do this, they actually did 4 focus groups with 20 Black lupus patients and 11 of their caregivers in Chicago and Boston. And before even getting the results, actually the introduction to this paper does a wonderful job of concisely describing why this topic is important. First, they say that the failure to represent diverse populations in clinical research violates ethical principles of distributive justice, which require that the burdens and benefits of research be equitably distributed. And then they also address one of the really many, but really big elephants in this in the room of this topic. And that's the relationship between genetics and race. Namely, there's an increasing awareness that race is a social construct and should not be used as a surrogate for genetic makeup. However, the authors at the same time point out that there is evidence of genetic variability both among Black individuals and between Black and white individuals. And therefore, if Black patients are not included in clinical trials, research findings related to a treatment, safety and efficacy will not be generalizable. So what that means is we need diversity in clinical trial participants to actually know how the population as a whole, with all of its diverse genetic, racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, and environmental factors, are going to respond to a treatment. I just thought that was a really well done way of understanding why this is an important topic. So again, they applied critical race theory to inform their study. And the reason they did this, and this is the other important thing from this paper, one of the many important things, is they applied this race theory because they actually couldn't find any published studies that explore the role of racism in clinical trial participation in rheumatology. They found studies that looked at racial representation, but they did not specifically look at racism as it applies to clinical trial participation. And critical race theory is a way of taking that as a given and putting it as in there as we are aware that racism is a part of US society. It is there. It takes it as a given. It doesn't look to see, is it there? It knows it's there. And that's a lens where once you know it's there, then you can ask what it's doing. So how does racism impact clinical trial enrollment among Black patients? And that's how they created their moderator guides. So there were a lot of takeaways from this study. So participants identified lack of trust and skepticism of research studies in light of both historical and personal experiences of racism. But at the same time, many expressed the desire to participate in clinical trials because they wanted to contribute to the greater good, especially helping others with lupus. But this is one takeaway for all providers with lupus patients, or really any patients. Before they participated, participants expressed it was extremely important for their own rheumatology providers to recommend participation in the trial. And this is another key thing, that provider had to be trustworthy, culturally competent, and a good listener. And it was also really important that that individual work for an institution that was involved in the community and was seen as being present and helping the local community rather than just using the community to accomplish their research goals. So we'd encourage everyone to read this paper. We're going to put it in the show notes. We think this is an important topic for a variety of reasons. But essentially, it really just highlights for all of us that efforts to increase enrollment in clinical and other studies have to acknowledge and respond to issues of racial bias. So tying all of this together, you know, we've talked about a lot of stuff here today. We've talked about incredible basic science studies that advance our knowledge of how it all works on a cellular level. We have new anti-NET antibodies, cytokine networks, CAR T cells, and PIM kinases. And ultimately, each of these topics might one day lead to treatments that improve patients' lives. And that is truly exciting. However, we have to acknowledge that these advances are occurring in a world where inequity continues to exist in clinical trial enrollment and other forms of research. And acting on this knowledge is not just for social science researchers or experts in diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's for all of us. So as we learn about these studies and talk about them in the tournament, let's also talk about how each of us can work to apply them equitably in whatever clinical or academic space which we work. So that is all of what we wanted to talk about today. Any other comments from you all?
Thanks for going through that. I think that was that's such an important aspect of how we take care of our patients. And I also think that it goes hand in hand with the discussion we had in the last episode, where I think part of the mistrust that some of these patients have with enrolling in clinical trials is seeing the lack of representation in our field as well. And if we had more representation, then I think we'd have more representative patients in our clinical trial. So it all kind of goes hand in hand. We just have to be really active about making these changes and not just waiting for them to happen.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it all ties together, and which is also why we're tying it all together in these podcasts. You know, some people might wonder, why are we talking about clinical trial enrollment as we're talking about, a silly fake competition between basic science papers. But really, everything we do has to be viewed through a lens of diversity, equity, inclusion, because that's the only way, as we make that part of the conversation normal, we're going to start to see the way these things tie together and recognize it and incorporate it on a regular basis in our lives. Y'all, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This was a lot of fun. I learned a ton from reading these scouting reports. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I can't wait for our next conversation where we talk about the teams in the what's going to be a truly incredible region in Animal House. So we will see you all next episode.